follow up and do him a
our document. We are now starting the year, the work of our term, because remember in the last we were still busy with the waiting the transition. So, but it doesn't mean that in whatever presentation we receive, we are not to check so that we are able to to see if it's not cut and paste. Some of us have got experience, and we are not implying that the department may fall into that. Having said that, I think we slept having received the news about our economy, and which means as a department that has been given an added responsibility of employment, what does that mean in us moving forward? But before that, we got a budget speech from the Minister of Finance, and I hope in listening we have picked up that we are remaining with the 5 cents that we have. So it then means we will have to do the best with what we have. But having to really be focused and show, I think from our side, all entities are important. But there are those that are more important, those that are in the center of the life and breath of this committee. Having said that, honorable members, and I want to, in terms of the budget, I really want to stress to members that we all received our copies. Let's go through those documents so that we are able, as we'll be preparing for our budget votes, we are able to reflect on those issues that we think are important, taking into account what then the department and all the presentations that are going to follow are saying. And how then do we navigate as we will be conducting our oversight through various methods, which this is one of them. We are able to be pointed to really say, to, as we said, we want to leave a legacy. Difficult as it is, but we'll have to leave a legacy in 2024. That we'll then be proud of. So it's going to start now. It won't start any time late. Having said that, welcoming everybody who's here. We do have an agenda in front of us. We've got a couple of apologies. The director of CCMA is stuck in traffic. He arrived this morning. Unfortunately, he couldn't sleep over. So because of that, we will then get an amendment of our agenda. We will get a presentation from the UIF. I also got a message that the whip, also their bus is stuck in traffic. She may be And I'm told Honorable Kado is also stuck in traffic. So they will find it in the middle of the presentation. We will then hand over to Commissioner Murupi to take us through his presentation. Sorry, GM.
We will be leaving, I think, if we are not done by 11. We are going to present the amendment bill on Quaida to the Cabinet Committee, so that the matter must also serve before the Cabinet. So in case we are not done before that time, we will quietly leave. Thank you.
The other apology, sorry, I thought that the minister has been put off. The DG is put off. I was teasing the PLO yesterday and in the corridors. I said, what's happening? If it's not the minister, it's the deputy minister. If it's not the deputy minister, it's the chair. If it's not the chair, it's the DG. I couldn't see Mark, eh?
And they should never have gone to Hong Kong on holiday.
Over to you, Commissioner. I don't know, the DM, is there anything that you would like to say before they start? Or should they?
I had thought that I'm going to pass because I see the chairperson not saying anything, that I must say something. We are in recession, and I'm worried when the chairperson is not giving me the opportunity to speak. How do we register such bad news for our honourable members to also know about that? So I was waiting upon the chairperson to give directive on this matter, whether to speak or not to speak.
No, you may speak.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry to make you feel bad on this one. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, honorable members. Chairperson, once more, thank you for this opportunity that you normally afford us as the executive authority to appraise you on development. And we do, among other officials that we are with here, Honorable Chairperson, we've got Mr. Virgil C. Field, who's our acting director general now, who's among us, so we need to register that. And obviously our head of office and the office, our office are here. Renali
Chief of Staff.
Yes, our Chief of Staff is here from the office. And our other officials, Madewa Baba and Dade, and the rest of the crew here, I see the chair, the CFO of the CFO of the UIF is also amongst the our team. I want to take this opportunity, Honorable Chairperson, as I said that we always want to be here up until the end. We like to, as a executive authority, to prioritize this portfolio committee because it is important. And without this committee, we have no job, actually. So that I'll be leaving, and my apologies. I think members will recall, Honorable Chairperson, that we come from this amendment, and finally we can report that we are tabling it today to the committee so that other processes should unfold so that it can then finally find its way to Parliament. Now, with the inclusion of domestic workers, remember this act does not include domestic workers, and because also of the fact that we have a case in point, we were taken to court by the daughter of a domestic worker who passed on some years back at work,
while this domestic worker was cleaning, doing the windows, and she fell. Apparently, she was partially blind. She fell into a swimming pool. I mean, she can't swim, and she's been working there for 22 years, and she fell and she died, and she was offered like $5,000 by the employer. And so the daughter of this lady took this matter to court on herself, with obviously with other groupings, and including the Domestic Workers Union, SASAU, which was supporting her on this matter. And there was a court judgment, a high court judgment, that this legislation is actually invalid because it doesn't cover domestic workers. So the matter is actually sitting before the Constitutional Court in end of this month, also to for the Constitutional Court to obviously invalidate it. So it is a very important milestone for us also. The department is long overdue, but we are taking necessary steps to make sure that it appears. We change this legislation to cover our people. So, Honorable Chair, also one of the dangers associated now with economic distress, I think we are aware now that there is a potential political instability, which is actually, in principle, can lead to a loss of confidence in a country like ours and produce an economic crisis that justifies the loss of confidence. So this economic vulnerability is what economists refer to as the self-fulfilling speculative attack. And this is when the market psychology becomes crucial, so crucial that within limits, the expectations, even the prejudices of investors become economic fundamentals. So the point here, Honorable Members, is that because the speculative attacks can be self-justifying, following this economic policy that makes sense in terms of the fundamentals will never be enough to assure market confidence. And this is where we are now. I'm sure we are all aware of that fact. And in fact, Honorable Members, the need to win confidence, back the confidence of our people, can actually prevent us from the following the sensible policies and force South Africa to follow policies that would normally seem extremely perverse. And surely we can afford this situation. And in my view, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, I'm not an economist myself, economic fundamentalist, and I'm sure it doesn't take anyone to know this, the fact that the views of many economists, and some of them, there is this amateurish psychological exercise in which I'm sure we know in terms of like these, the IMF always tries to persuade countries to do things they hope could actually be perceived by the markets as favorable. They would actually like us in this situation, in this situation of distress. The IMF is ready to pounce on us for us to come. Obviously, they will open their doors. So I think I firmly believe that the success of every economy will always be based on sound economic policy, a good and evolving plan to implement that economic policy, and a great amount of discipline in doing so. And I'm sure in this instance, whether we agree or we don't agree, or we come from different schools of thought, I think that the economic recovery document from Treasury is trying to actually deal with some of these issues that are currently facing our country. So we have to open up ourselves on some of the possibilities. So, and I'm sure now officially, Honorable Members, our country has entered the third recession since 1994. And we can't deny this, and there's no amount of prepared notes and speeches that will rescue the economy more than just simply fixing the fundamentals, that, like the President always says, that we have to fix our economy. And in the words of the Chairperson, I want to quote the Chairperson. Chairperson, you once said that, I quote you, that this happens at a time when we are leaders. Now, all these things, all this recession happens at that time, all of us, we are leaders. Sometimes we might have wished that we shouldn't be here when these things happen, but it is unfortunate, whether fortunate or unfortunate, that everything happens at the time we are now here, and there's nothing we can do about it because we are here. So this happened also, Chair, when our SOEs are struggling to recover in the country, where 32,000 to 50,000 applications can be received for just one advertised post at an entry-level position. You advertise one entry-level position, you get more than 50,000 applications.
of people with master's degrees for an entry-level job. So you can imagine the crisis that we are facing. We might want to downplay it, but it is serious. And at some point, maybe at some point, Chair, the committee might want to give itself time to put everything aside and discuss this thing, because whether we like it or not, jobs and jobs affect this department, because now we are employment and labor, and we have never given ourselves the time and opportunity to begin to unpack what does it mean to this portfolio committee. I think we must begin to discuss these matters, Honorable Chairperson. And this also happens, Honorable Members, in a country where the concept of work, employment and unemployment needs much clarity, and a South African definition of what work, employment and unemployment really means to us, to all of us. You know, we should be all here abreast of the fact that in India, with the 1.2 billion population, and then they will register less than 3% unemployment rate, because everybody, whether you are a street vendor, you are registered as an employer or as employed. So to us, our definition of unemployed, even people who are actually entrepreneurs and self-employed, are not registered or recorded in South Africa as employed or self-employed. We need to change that concept and actually follow the convention in terms of the ILO, some of the ILO conventions as to what do we define as an employed person, and something like that. So including in many other countries like China and everywhere else where there is a high population but the unemployment rate is very low and next to nothing, but based on how they classify employment. So we need to begin to, and I think those are the answers that this committee, I challenge to you, Chair, and the committee, to begin to discuss and advise, actually, in Parliament about some of these things. We need a much clearer definition, and I believe that maybe the CCMA and the UIF, working together with SSA, are more than capable to assist this country in dealing with this fundamental and topical issue also. And when the whole world is battling the spread of coronavirus, Honorable Chairperson, our country finds itself on the verge of despair and having to handle this coronavirus issue or phenomenon and recession at the same time. So it's, and I'm sure this is at the test of character for all of us who still believe that out of this current situation, our country has an opportunity to be one of the best economies in the world. We can do it when we put our mind to it, all of us. And Honorable Members, Chairperson, I know that you might think that I'm getting too dramatic. I don't want to bore you with many other issues. But also to report to you, Honorable Chairperson, that we will be launching as this department, myself together with the minister, because he's back from hospital, I think it's tomorrow, yes, it's tomorrow, we will be launching the national hotline on the national minimum wage, the Impimba hotline that we have been talking about all this time. There will be a crossover between Cape Town and Hatfield. The minister will be responding from Hatfield because he can't fly. So, and we will also be, you will be happy, Honorable Members, that we will be leading our department's Dell Services program to the people of the Eastern Cape on Friday. In the morning, we'll be meeting with employers in the Eastern Cape this coming Friday. We'll be going to East London, we'll be going to Coffin Harbour, and to take our services to the people. And we made a commitment to the Portfolio Committee at some point that such events must always extend an invitation to members of the Portfolio who might be deployed in some of those areas, who will have the opportunity to attend and be with us and see what is it that we are doing at this department. So we are extending our invitation to the committee and members, those who we think that it will enhance our accountability levels and the committee oversight. And I hope that the UIF commissioner also will be inviting members for their oversight in one of our labor activation programs that was launched that 24th February 2020. The commissioner, I'm sure, will talk more about this program in his presentation. And I must say also, Honorable Chairperson and members, that I did receive immediately after the presentation of the compensation fund in our last meeting, I did receive an email from Honorable Dana from about some of the complainants that they were reporting about. We have responded that the matter is receiving attention. We have forwarded the information, all of it, to the commissioner to follow it through, and I'm sure in due course the commissioner will have responded and directly to Mr. Honorable Dana on this matter. We are doing something. It's not like, as it was reported, that there's nothing. We are putting also pressure that we must see progress, whether is there such cases. If there are, let's elevate them, let's make sure that we help. But I want to take also this opportunity, Honorable Chairperson, to thank you and your members of this portfolio committee for always being tough on us and for your upright leadership character. We hope all of us learned some lessons from the meeting with the compensation fund last week. And we are in the process, all of us, of strengthening controls and improving services of all our entities. So that is why when you call us, we all come. There can't be any excuse. That is why that Dema Rubin is here and everybody else. Actually, if it was possible, I'm sure Mr. Seafield will have actually brought the entire office here. But we want to show you that we, at all times, we will be on alert if you want us to come to account. Will always be here. Thank you so much.
No, thank you very much, DM. I think as we will be asking questions and when we want to make comments during the time of the answer and question time, we'll reflect on some of the issues that you have raised. But thank you very much. Well, unfortunately, the director of SUSMA has arrived, but we've already amended our agenda. So UIF will then start, then you will follow. Thank you. I nearly said honorable. Commissioner, over to you.
Chairperson, I hope it's not a prophecy or something.
Whilst we are busy with the IT, I think all of us we know one another, but there are few faces that I don't will deal with the introduction. There's a lady just in front of me. Can we use the mic and you tell us who you are, from where, your name and your surname and the institution you represent?
Okay, my name is Mocha Muchemwa. I'm from PMG and I'm a law student at UCT.
No, we know all the ones
behind. They are part of the furniture, so
she's the only one.
No, we're
done.
Yeah, but okay.
Next time you will know. As I'm calling them, you'll pick up who is talking. Okay, so that's the disadvantage of being a lone voice, the majority. Okay, over to you. That was on a lighter note. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair and members and Deputy Minister. I was just pondering on this statement by the Chair that all the challenges facing the country are happening at the time when we are leaders. Just the thought of it is scary, Chairperson. That we are leaders, as I'm the head of UIF, I think that the pressure, just hearing the statement, I almost wanted to request to be excused, Chair. But we have to, yeah. Chair, I'm going to...
I don't know, there's some And I don't want to go into that space of KZN. What is happening, Mr. Ngozi? Why are you? Okay, it's KZN. I don't want to come into that space. As long as you are smiling, that's what is important. And what I'm finding very strange is that you arrived, both of you, at the same time. You know, that makes me more scary.
We stayed together and we had the same problem.
Oh, okay. No, we got the message. Welcome. Over to you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to start on slide 20. Not that the previous slides are not important, but the slide 1 to 19 are the slides that refers to the mandate of the URF and what URF is about, which we discussed in the workshop with the committee. I just want to go straight to the performance of the fund. What I'm reflecting here, Chair, in the internal audit report is just to give the committee an assurance that the performance that we are presenting today has been audited by internal audit to confirm that, yes, indeed, if you say we've achieved whatever percentage that we've achieved, it has been tested, and there's evidence that confirms that performance. on slide 21 is just a breakdown that internal audit confirmed that out of the 15 targets, we've achieved 12. And then on slide 22, it's just an alignment that as management, we said we've achieved certain targets and we give to internal audit. Where it's green is a confirmation that what we said is green. And where it's red is internal audit confirming to us that you said as management, you've not achieved, and we're also confirming as internal audit that the target has not been achieved. That's the reflection on slide 22 and slide 23. On slide 25, members, what we're highlighting here is how we performed as URF, comparing ourselves to how we performed the previous year. Last year, quarter one, we had achieved 63%, and this year we've seen a 10% improvement to 73%. And in quarter two, we had a 63% performance last year, and this year we see a 17% improvement, sitting at 80% in quarter two. In the next slide, just starting from slide 27, now here I'm working members through target per target of the 15 targets. What I'm lifting up here, Chairperson and members, is what the Portfolio Committee had requested, that we need to reflect the numbers that inform the percentage. Quite often we'll be saying we've achieved 13% against a target of 15%, but we don't show what are the numbers behind the percentage. We've updated the presentation to reflect as such, so that members can have a feel of the volumes that you are referring to. And here, this is our vacancy rate. Even though it's achieved and we're sitting below 10%, I think the Deputy Minister did highlight an example here that we would advertise a position at level 6 or level 7, and the number of applications we'd receive would go up to 50,000, including people who have a master's degree and honors and degrees, some of them have diplomas, but the position requires a matric. It's a level 6 position with matric, with 2 years experience, but the number of applications they receive is huge. And that's why sometimes it takes us long to process the application that we received. We've looked at this situation here, because there's only 49 positions, and if you receive 50,000 per position, you can imagine the number of applications that we receive is about 250,000 that we would receive for just this position. We've set as management at DEFCOM, and we are considering bringing to increase the number of learners, of interns that we have, so that amongst other things, we give them an opportunity to run this administrative process, because these applications, they must be captured, they must be checked whether they meet the requirements, and then captured in a spreadsheet for the committee to see and consider. And one of the things we're looking at is to bring interns, at least maybe bring them for a period of 3 years, to see if they cannot close this gap. And also maybe get a workplace experience that they may be requiring for higher positions when the position requires 2 years and more years of experience. And the next target that we've missed was the one of developing our integrated claim systems. What brought us in this area was the contract we had with the previous service provider ended just when they finished developing some of the reports. And in order for us to avoid incurring irregular expenditure, we allowed that contract to end. Because the complexity of the solution, it was undermined at the time. They were not too sure when they applied. They thought it's just a common social security platform that will just plug and play. And we entered the environment of UIF, it's a different environment, totally. And we have now appointed a new service provider that are busy developing the solution. And the plan is that by September this year, we'll go live with the solution. And then the other target is that I want to highlight is on slide 33, is on the number of learners that have been trained. Here, members, as you recall, the Department of Labor was renamed to Employment and Labor. And one of the things we did as a department was to press pause on the training program. Some of the training programs continued, but we said we cannot continue ignoring the situation that the country is facing of unemployment. And also training without enforcing that people must be trained into employment. And that's the reason why that we missed this target for the quarter, to review our training programs, to make sure that these training programs, they actually provide employment opportunities for people that are trained. If not, it's not employment opportunities, they at least provide an opportunity for these trainees to become employers and create jobs for other people. And the second target that we've missed is on training layoff schemes, which has now been renamed to Temporary Employer Employee Relief Scheme. Here, the main issue that caused us to delay was, pardon me, was the way the training layoff scheme was structured in 2008. It was structured such that you have UIF providing wage scheme, and then you have the CETAs providing the training intervention. And these interventions were married to each other, such that you are not able to pay the wage scheme if the training program has not started, and vice versa, the training program doesn't start unless there's agreement with the wage scheme. At the time of implementation, some of the CETAs did not have a training layoff scheme in their budget. They only had other training programs except the training layoff scheme. And they had to go back to their committees to negotiate an additional budget. And committees, or both committees, sit every quarter. And this delayed implementation of the training layoff scheme. What we did as a department in the process is to de-link the training program from the wage subsidy, so that we are able to provide an intervention for the wage subsidy whilst the training program can also happen independently from the wage subsidy. But the two can happen at the same time, then the two sometimes don't always have to happen at the same time. Because not every company requires both wage subsidy and salary and a training subsidy. They may require one or the other of both, and want to be able to intervene separately on the two items. Chair, in the next slide, on slide 37, what we are reflecting here is just to give the portfolio committee a feel of how the provinces are performing in terms of turnaround time, just for the committee to have a feel, but not really to walk you through, but at least to see how each province is performing, and also to have sight of the volumes in each province. As you can see, as an example, that Gauteng in quarter two processed 150,000, and followed by KwaZulu-Natal, and the next one in line is Western Cape. So these are the three volume drivers in the work that UIF does. And then I'm going to go straight to, I want to just spend a few minutes on this slide, Chair, on slide 44. On slide 44, what you're showing, just for members to link the report that was received yesterday about recession, and also about the budget vote, and also the report from StatsSA, that what you see here is the top five industries that are the claim drivers: your trade, personal services, building, air, and agriculture. These are the main sectors that are driving unemployment benefits at URM. And when you see in the next column on the age categories, you can also see that more than 52% of people who come to apply are young people, which makes the problem that you have of the youth unemployment even worse. That youth are unemployed and even more youth are losing jobs as they come to apply for benefits. In the last piece at the bottom of top benefits claims reasons, you can see that the two main drivers, the main one is contract expires, 40%, which reflects that more people are employed in contract positions and not permanent employment, or they are employed as seasonal workers. As you said earlier, that these are in agriculture and construction. So people are employed in a construction environment, they put a building, once a building is done, they are retrenched, they go home. Or they are working in your seasonal employment in agriculture where they are planting. When it's off season, they are sent home, they come and claim for URF. And this is a reflection of what was reported yesterday about recession and the status of about the jobs that you are losing. And then maybe the other scary picture that is on slide 48, which then informed our labor activation program. You can see from here on this slide that only 4% of the people who come to claim are people with above matric qualification. The rest of the people, the 96%, has matric and below. But what is scary more is that only 29% has matric. So that means 67% of people who come to apply for unemployment insurance benefit has below matric qualification, which makes the problem that the country faces even worse, that we also have a skills problem. And then this aligns with the priorities that the president announced previously, which includes a skills development element. And then on slide 49 is a reflection about which gender is affected the most. And no, I don't know if it's not this one. On slide 49 is a reflection of the gender distribution. On 47% at this stage reflect that is females, and 53% is male. But the industries that are affected more by female, I think I missed that slide as I was going through. It's on slide 47. Sorry to take you back and forth. On this slide, Chairperson and members, you can see that there are certain industries that are mainly driven by females, and we are losing more jobs again there. You can see in the food industry, the professional services, 60% in the agriculture space is driven by women, and they are losing jobs. In the banking industry, 57% is women. So that's an indication on what, as we intervene, we need to be focusing on. I'm going to move swiftly, Chair, and allow the CFO to talk to us about the spinach of you. It's on slide 59.
Good morning, honorable members. I'll then take you through to the expenditure report. In terms of program one, we have underspent there by 3%. This is where we budget for admin fees, our compensation of employees, as well as our other ICT projects. The main reason for our underspending there is that we've got vacancies that are currently sitting at 8%. And then we also have allocated money for performance bonuses. But I think we've applied stricter rules for awarding performance bonuses, hence you see that we have underspent there. So people that get bonuses is people that have really overperformed, you know, and went an extra mile. Then program number two, you'd also note there, members, that we have overspent there. And the underspending is due to the unemployment benefits that we pay to our beneficiaries. If you'd recall that in 2017, we have a new amended act, the UI Act, that was approved and whose aim was to improve the benefits of our beneficiaries. So we're starting to see the impact of the new act in this current financial year. The budget has been increased in line with the actuarial valuations, because we've done an actuarial valuation to look at and project in terms of the history, how many more benefits are we still going to be paying. And looking at the current unemployment, our claims are going very high. If you look at last year, this time, we had paid around 6 billion on benefits. But this year, in September, we've already paid 8 billion. So we're seeing the impact of the new act. Under Program 3, we have underspent, hugely underspent there. That is on labor activation programs. The main reason for that is that some of these companies or the training providers don't comply with the MOA that has been signed, so it delays the payment of the next tranches. We pay them in tranches, so if there's an element of non-compliance, we don't give them the second tranche until they've satisfied the conditions of the MOA. In total, our spending for the second quarter was about 9.4 billion. And we've underspent, or we've overspent, sorry, by 1.5 billion. And that has been corrected in the third quarter because there was a budget review, and we have since improved or increased our budget on our beneficiaries. Chair, I will not take the members through the last paragraph of the presentation. It's the same thing. It's just that we've broken it down in terms of compensation of employees, goods and services. On goods and services, members, we've underspent there, and the main reason for that is the cost containment measures that we've put in place that, to ensure that we reduce our costs. On the CAPEX, as indicated earlier, it's mainly around the delays in finalizing some of the ICT projects. So we are projecting that come the third quarter, we would see an improvement in terms of our spending on the CAPEX. I'll end up there, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you, CFO. Chair, I'll move swiftly to slide 84. I think on this slide, Chair, what you want to highlight to the members is the intervention. Let me put it differently. The members had previously asked us to also bring some of the targets that we have in place and also show the impact it has on the society and also the problems that we are facing as a country. On this slide, Chair, we are talking about the temporary employer-employee relief scheme. That at this stage, on slide, okay, I have 281s. The first one. The second one, my apologies. The second 81, it's supposed to have been 84. Pardon me, Chair. On this slide, what you're showing, Chair, is where we've intervened. We've intervened in 27 companies that were on the brink of a shutdown. And over 3,000 people would have lost jobs, and we spent 101 million rands to save these companies. I just did a quick calculation. It has cost us 30,000 rands to save one job. It may look expensive to another person, but when you compare this against the cost of creating a job, creating one job costs about 250,000 when you check against other researches. So to keep one person employed, especially with the stuff that we have presented earlier about the nature of where the jobs are lost, and also the skills level. To take these people back into employment would have cost us more. And the economy is not creating jobs. So it's important that whilst we are trying to create more jobs, that those that are employed, we still keep them employed. And this is what this has done, Chairperson and members. And what we're showing on slide 87 is just a reflection of the companies where we've intervened, so that we keep a transparent report to the members that they know when we say we've saved companies, which companies are we talking to, and where are these companies in the country, and also in which sector? Out of the 27, the majority is the majority of the companies are in the textile and manufacturing. 12 of these companies are in manufacturing, and the 7 are in the textile, which is a reflection of where the economy is in distress the most, in the clothing industry and also the manufacturing. And the other area I want to bring to members that was requested previously was on training of unemployed. Previously we had presented about a KZN project to give members of some of the labor activation programs that we are implementing. And members requested that we need to give a breakdown of the institutions that are working with us and the nature of the work that they're doing. Just avoiding to have a longer presentation, what we've covered here is the institutions themselves that we have. Just on slide 97, Chair, you will see at the top we have NAFSA's. No, let me. I want to show the one that has. Yes. Slide 99, sorry. I wanted to show the one that has the number of people that are in training. On slide 99, we have institutions that are actively involved in projects right now. JLQ-based, KZN-based, Umhlathuze has projects across the country in all the provinces. PCR has projects across all the provinces. And we also have projects in Mpumalanga with the Mpumalanga Regional Training Trust, where SA Technology Network, it has projects across the country. This is number 8 on the slide. We had projects with Mpumalanga Economic Development Agency, that's for the Mpumalanga area. Nelson Mandela University, Walter Sisulu, are projects in the Eastern Cape. And then in the next slide, also reflects projects in the Western Cape, with the Western Cape Community College and Northlink Technical College, which is one of the best technical colleges that we have interventions with. We have a project also with Northern Cape Rural TVET College for the Northern Cape. And this is just a list, members and chair, of the project that we have across the country that the Deputy Minister spoke about earlier, that would have to take the Portfolio Committee on a visit to some of the projects for the Portfolio Committee to have a feel of some of the projects that we are implementing. And what we have on slide 102 is just a breakdown on the gender distribution. That the ones that we have in place right now, 13,000 of them are female and only 7,000 are males, and more than half of these people that are in training are young people. So 17,000, which is more than 70%, are young people. So our projects are directed at the youth, but we're not ignoring people that have contributed to UIF that may be older. I think the disruptors, I presented them previously, Chair. I'll stop here. Maybe we'll respond to other issues when we get questions. Thanks, Chair.
No, thank you very much, Commissioner. Members, there is the presentation. Can we get some hands? Honorable Bigram, Honorable Inanna, Honorable Zuma, Honorable Kado, Honorable Ngwezi. In that order.
Thank you, Madam Chair. May I go ahead?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. I appreciate it, and I see a lot of work has been done. I just want to go through a couple of issues, and some are specific and some are more general, but let's just quickly go through them. First of all, I note that your system is often offline. I get that. Somehow it's just not functional. I get complaints all the time, and it's normally just a system problem, as opposed to a problem with the institution. And maybe you could tell us what you're doing about it. I know you also said you're getting a new service provider again. I think you change them every year, from what I remember. We are possibly, and I don't want to hold my breath, but we're possibly expecting a mass retrenchment in the civil service if our Minister of Finance has his way. Are you ready and geared for that? Do we have the finances for it? Do you have the staff? Are you ready for such a thing? It could be tens of thousands of people. Following on from that, we're hearing across the world that the virus is also creating lots of retrenchments and dismissals. Countries like China are just giving people nothing. Are we ready for that? Do we have the finances again? Just quickly to have a look at the issue with the domestic workers, your leader, since she's not here. Why did we wait 25 years before they were registered for UIF? And why did it take a court case to force the department to suddenly do it? And then finally, why has the department appealed to the Constitutional Court when they lost the case? Maybe you can answer those questions. I don't know if you're in a position to answer them. We, as you said, we've entered the recession. That's going to put more pressure on you. Over and above the mass retrenchments of the civil service and the virus, the recession is going to add to that as well. Quickly to have a look at the training layoff scheme with its new fancy name, more or less the same thing. It was never taken up by the unions anyway. I'm not sure if you're going to make it more palatable and easier to access, but my interaction with the unions is they just never actually wanted the training layoff scheme at all. I did note your slide about the mass of the biggest group of people who claim the UIF are those with a contract expired. I think it's almost 40% or something you pointed out. The reality is our government has spent a lot of time trying to outlaw those short-term contracts and short-term employees. And yet that's creating the most employment. So if we do put more pressure on that, we're just going to put more people out on the streets. And maybe you want to comment on that. I also note your slide on the skills. In other words, the people who haven't got matric, the people who are below matric.
That will be the last one in this group.
Okay, I'll hold there. Thanks.
Honourable Renan.
Thank you very much, and welcome as well the presentation. Commissioner, one thing that I'm raising for second or third time now, that the valuable information that we are given and we are having, is that information available to the community? We talk about the UIF and the claims that people have made. But when you go to the community, whether you're going to the Eastern Cape or the Free State or here in the Western Cape, where I've been, many people don't know how to process. And I once requested that we need to have a public outreach program where people are going to be informed, so that when these things are happening, what is it that they must do? You made a very sensitive information that a domestic who worked for 25 years fell in the swimming pool and died and was only paid 5,000. She is not the only one who is suffering that abuse. There are many that happens because people don't have the information. Others are injured, others are laid off because of health hazard problems, but they don't know what is it that they must do. I know of people who worked for, in the Western Cape, there is what is called, people are working for each other. People work for 1, 2, or 3 days per week. And when those people get dismissed for whatever reason, they don't have anything, they don't know where to go in order to claim. Hence I'm saying that we need to have a public outreach to educate the people so that people do have that information in advance so that they know what is it that they will do when such things are happening. On page 44, Chaperson, the list of the entities where the claims have been processed is listed there. But I'm interested on those that are not seasonal, like agriculture. We know that agriculture, when whatever product or crop is finished, people had to be laid off for the construction. When the hospital, for instance, is completed, people had to be laid off. That is understandable. But what are the top five that are permanently employing people? Because there are companies that have been there for a number of years. And when those people who are working in those companies are being challenged with the issues of transfers, dismissal, for whatever reason, and people don't know what is it that they must do. And this is, I'm saying that is a lack of information, what is it that we must do. Chairperson, on page 49, I accept the presentation about gender and the age categories, where the breakdown is being made. What is missing? And I don't know whether this is deliberate, because this is not the only forum where this is deliberately omitted, the issue of race. And I know when people talk about race, people get fired up, people become so uncomfortable. It is good that the breakdown is about the race, that is how many women, how many men are affected, and so on, their age group. That is very valuable information. But go further and say in terms of race. Because we may group together and say that black people are the victims. But they are not the only one. There are many racial groups that are getting advantage or disadvantage because of their gender. Not only because of their race, also because of their gender. I am saying that when this breakdown is being made, the gender and age categories, it's fine. Go further and talk about the race as well. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Honorable Zuma.
Thanks, Chairperson. We are busy talking about the provinces that they fail to achieve their performances. For instance, Limpopo and Gauteng Commissioner. But what I'm worried about is that in those provinces, we've got people who are working there almost every day. And I'm just wondering, even if the head office it's not performing very well, the head office where most of the people are there. So I just want to know, Commissioner, that as the committee, how are you going to convince this committee that something is going to be done or something is going to happen, or failing which, I think the committee must also intervene or go there and make some oversight visit in those provinces so that they will see that the work is done. Secondly, Chairperson, it's about the project which is assisting our youth in all provinces. I don't know whether the department after the training of those youth, they just handed over the project, and after that they don't do the follow-up to see whether is it still existing, functioning, doing very well, or it's just giving them once and for all. So I just wish to know what is happening about those projects. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you,
Ricardo.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've got three questions. The first one relates to irregular expenditure. In the audit report from 2018-19, the Auditor General said that he couldn't find adequate evidence in the UIS financial statements to substantiate some of the figures that had been mentioned there. And he also noted that the UIS had failed to take disciplinary measures against officials who had incurred or permitted irregular expenditure to the tune of 86 million rand. Which brings me to slide 65 of your presentation, where it's mentioned that there are 13 confirmed cases of irregular expenditure to the tune of 107 million rand. I want to know what time period do the 10 cases currently under investigation amounting to 12 million rand refer to, and are both these figures, in other words, the figure relating to the 13 confirmed cases and the figure relating to the 10 cases under investigation, do those include that figure of 86 million rand that was mentioned in the Auditor General's report last year? And then secondly, have disciplinary steps been taken in the 13 confirmed cases of irregular expenditure amounting to 107 million rand? And if so, what steps have been taken? Secondly, have the business rescue practitioners of South African Airways approached the Unemployment Insurance Fund about the possibility of using its 100 billion rand surplus to fund retrenchments that might have to take place at the airline? And if so, what are the details? And then thirdly and finally, we know that COSATU has proposed that a special purpose vehicle be put together that includes PIC money, Development Bank money, and UIF money to take over 50% of Eskom's 450 billion rand debt. Has the UIF been in any conversations with COSATU and or the finance ministry about that eventuality, and if so, what are the details? Thanks.
Can I on a matter that I think we may be, should I say, unfair? The issues around business rescue processes. My understanding is that it has been reported that whole package of the business rescue thing will be submitted by the end of March. Is it fair to then request to get some snippets, if I can say that, of that? Can we, if there, I'm not answering for them, but I'm just making members to be aware that there are those processes, and therefore we are to respect them. Honourable Ngwezi?
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. I actually have one question, since other questions have already been asked. The question is mainly on the expenditure report, that there is overspending of about 1.5 billion rand. But then I heard that has been addressed in the adjustment budget also. But looking at the amount available is that amount available going to take us through the end of the financial year? Because I think that's very important. And the last one is a comment, Honourable Chair. I had a comment that when they are supposed to fill vacancies, they receive a lot of applications, sometimes 15,000 per post or position for people with even higher degrees and so. But what do we expect our people to do? If that is seen or is causing delays in the filling of vacancies, I think it's fair for people to apply. What we should be looking at is how do we then use the internal resources to fast track your capturing interviews and all that, short listings and all that. Because that's the unfortunate part in all institutions of employment in this country. I remember in one municipality, the positions that were advertised somewhere around August capturing has just ended, when I asked a certain mayor, what's happening with those positions, he said, no, we have just finished, you know, capturing of the people, because we received about 30,000 applications. And, you know, we can't complain. We rather use the resources present or available to actually pass and meet all the requirements before anybody else could be interviewed or the position can be filled. And we'll always appreciate, you know, using the list, but to do more. Thank you, Chair.
No, thank you, honorable members. For me, it's page 49, a breakdown by gender and age. Is it possible to also get a reflection if there are any people with disability? Page 69. Oh, sorry, honorable, my apologies. Honorable Mdab.
Thanks, Chair. Just one question, but maybe let me start with a comment that the Deputy Minister raised the issues which affect our economic growth. Therefore, what would be the role of this department as well as us as a portfolio committee? I think, Chair, it would be proper that we, in our programming, we find a way or a suitable date whereby we'll deliberate specifically on these matters, especially in relation to what has transpired from yesterday's pronouncement by the President. So that we are seen to be driving a program forward and we have understood what impact Steph SA has pronounced on yesterday. One question that relates to the presentation, it's the fruitless and wasteful expenditure. There is no detailed report that says this fruitless and wasteful expenditure of 79 million, where is it coming from, and what are the measures put in place to deal with such, except to say that it is monitored in the office of the commissioner. Now, the one that has been referred to by Honorable Cardo in relation to irregular expenditure and this fruit and wasteful expenditure might have a negative audit outcome if it's not addressed properly and dealt with timeously, so that by the time we submit our AFS, we have already dealt with these issues. So I just want to get clarity as to how far we are in dealing with them. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Mdabe. Your latter question was the question that I was also going to ask. Can we then get a response from the Commissioner and the CFO?
Thank you, Chairperson and members. We'll start with the questions from Honorable Bahrain. System is on and offline. Yes, it's true, the system is on and offline. I think the availability of the system at this stage is sitting at 95% availability. But I think it could be the 5% when it's offline that people experience the most issues. We are busy addressing the issue since our data center moved to CETA. But we are managing that service level agreement tightly so that the offline period does not happen at the peak. Because quite often it happens when the demand for the system is high, and that's when we suffer the most and we receive more calls. But we are on top of that issue. Hopefully, as we introduce our online platform, our USSD, and also the app, that we hope that the pressure on the system will reduce, and also make our free Wi-Fi available. possibilities of mass retrenchment, be it through the public services or the coronavirus, or as a result of recession. We did our actuarial evaluation prior to our annual budget, and in that actuarial evaluation, we're able to stretch our budget such that we have a technical reserve available should retrenchments go skywire. I think we put aside about just over 30 billion rand should things, 43, we put aside 43 billion rand. Yes, unless things turn differently, but we put a technical reserve of about 43 billion rand should such a scenario materializes. The issue around the domestic worker taking 25 years, I think that question is for CF. We've already sorted out issues around domestic workers at UIF a long time ago. I think the DG will respond to that. Yes. Okay. The issue around TERS, which was not taken up by organized labor previously, I cannot speak for organized labor, but I can definitely explain what UIF has done to date. We've managed to bring organized labor on board, because at that point there was no understanding on what TLS was about and what the intention is. As we speak, the newly formed temporary employee relief scheme has been discussed with organized labor at NETLEC. We are improving the process as we move along. Just yesterday, I even met Sabtu in the Western Cape, just to see how much more can we do to improve TERS. So we are bringing them on board to make sure that this works. I'm going to leave the issue around contract workers to the acting DG to respond to, and go to Honourable Yenana's questions around availability of information in the community, how we are communicating UIF offerings. We picked up this gap ourselves, that we are not communicating as much as we would like to. I think what we've done at the most, we've been communicating using your big media, where we put a billboard, we have an advert in the city press, sometimes in the Sowetan. But we have not gone to the community radio stations, where we are able to engage the community to the stations where they listen to. The Deputy Minister did touch earlier on us taking services to the people in the Eastern Cape. We are going to Kofimva on Saturday, and on Friday we'll be in East London. And one of the reports I presented the last time was we are procuring 9 mobile buses, which will enable us to go to the rural of the rural. It's part of the interventions that we're coming up with to go to the communities and engage them. But it's not enough at this stage. I acknowledge that, Honourable Member, that we need to do some more to go to the communities and talk to them some more. And we've tasked the head of communications to unpack and give us more leeway in making sure that we engage our communities more. The issues around breaking down into race, it was not omitted deliberately. It just didn't cross our mind, I must confess that. We didn't really think that you need to put race or disability, as the chairperson has mentioned. But in the next report, we'll make sure that information is available. Issues around that were raised by Honourable Zuma on areas that have missed targets. Our main concern at this stage is Limpopo. I think Limpopo has missed targets for 2 successive quarters. When they missed the target in the first quarter, we have a team that you call the Rapid Response Team that is in Gauteng, that has turned around how Gauteng processes. We've sent it to Limpopo and we've seen an improvement in quarter 2, and we've also seen an improvement in quarter 3. But they are not yet where we want them to be. To an extent that this Friday I'm also going to Limpopo myself to engage Limpopo and see how best we can tighten up where there's issues of concern. Just last week, Thursday, we had a TEXCOM, even the Director General spoke to the Limpopo team on how they need to improve their performance. They are the only one outstanding at this stage. But we are keeping our eyes on Limpopo, and hopefully when we visit them this Friday, we expect to see further turnaround when we start in the new year. Around irregular expenditure, whether there was enough evidence it's a debatable matter. Our engagement with the Auditor General, the main issue that they had a concern with was consequence management. When the auditing us, we did give them the required evidence for all the regular expenditure that has happened. Consequence management, there was a justification as why we didn't do it at that time. We did engage our legal team, we engaged our corporate services, and at that point in time, the advice given was there's no need to discipline anyone, given, okay, let me just go track back a bit. What we did at the point of disciplinary, we asked, the first step that you do is to ask the person you're going to discipline to justify why you should not discipline them. And they wrote a legally sound case that upon consideration, the corporate services team felt that we shouldn't discipline because they've justified why they took the steps that they took. We are taking that case under review. We've given it to the legal team to review and see if we should discipline. We're expecting a report in the next week on what steps we could take if there's a need to discipline again. And that case constituted the main part of our irregular expenditure. Our irregular expenditure is sitting at 101. We have one case of 86 million. That is taking the most part of that, and that's the one that is in question as we speak now. Maybe just to give, I think, Chair, you've covered us on the business rescue practitioners around both Eskom and South African Airways. It's premature for us to make any utterance here on where the process is and what is happening. And I'd rather we allow the process to unfold and reach its normal process. And then at that point, we'll provide feedback on what our involvement has been to date. CFO, let me see. Maybe just on the issue around the budget, whether we'll have enough money or not to pay benefits, just to bring members into context, when the effort approved was when the president, is it accent? Yeah, when the president signed on the 1st of January 2019, yeah, I always struggle with this word, on the 1st of January 2019, at that point in time, the budget process has already passed us. And in the previous year, we had put money aside for benefits. And when the Auditor General came, they said, but you keep putting money aside, but you don't implement. So in the financial year for 2019, by 1st of January, the cycle of budgeting had already passed. September, the point where you review our budget. In August, you submit the new budget. So by the time 1st January came in, the September 2018 had passed. And hence, we are using now the budget of the new year, and we've revised now the budget in September this year, last year, to cater for these additional benefits that we put in place. So we're quite comfortable that we'll be able to meet our obligations to our beneficiaries. CFO, I think there's usually only regular. Yes.
Thank you, Chair. If I could just add to what the Commissioner has also indicated about the solvency of the fund. We are solvent and will be able to pay our benefits. We did an actuarial evaluation and we looked at the next 10 years to say, in the worst case scenario, will we be able to pay all our liabilities, and it was proven that yes, we are very solvent, we will be able to pay all our liabilities. On the question of, Commissioner has touched Honorable Cardo's question on irregular expenditure. Of the 107, 86 million is due to Accenture, and it's over a period of 3 years. The remaining balance is also different companies, but the main challenge that we had is around contract management, where we exceeded the contract amount by more than 15% without getting approval from National Treasury. We have since put controls to ensure that if there is a need for us to exceed a contract by more than the permissible limit, we consult National Treasury prior to any variance being exceeded. You also asked a question on the lifespan or the time that it has taken for us to finalize the investigation of cases. These cases
of amounting to 12 million, they range between 3 to 9 months in terms of investigation. Some have been finalized, but we're not happy with the outcome. So we had to refer them back for investigation, because if a report doesn't tell you who to discipline, it's as good as not being finalized. So those cases have been reopened for them to finally come up with a conclusive recommendation for us to be able to take action. Then there was also another question from Honorable Mdabi around the issue of the fruitless expenditure that we have not been explicit to say what is this. About 75 million of the fruitless expenditure is due to the SEP licenses that we've paid for the system. If you link the our performance, there's an indicator there around the ICM system that we have not implemented. So we've paid licenses, but we have delayed in terms of implementing the system. Hence, this expenditure is regarded as fruitless. What we are doing now, we are in the process of implementing the system. Commissioner has indicated that we have appointed a new service provider who's going to do the reports, finalize that part of the system development and the reports, so that we are able to implement the system. But we are also in the process of ensuring that we implement the recommendations of the investigation. Because if there's a fruitless expenditure, there is an investigation and there are recommendations that are put there by the investigator. Chair, I think we've also responded to the question by Honorable Ngwezi on the overspending on the benefits of the 1.5 billion. And this is just a matter of timing. When we budgeted, we were still busy with the system development and in the process of coming up with the implementation plan of how we were going to pay the benefits, especially the arrear ones. If you recall, the Act was approved in 2017, but we started paying in 2019. So our budgeting was just aligned as well to the implementation plan for ensuring that we pay in arrears our beneficiaries. But I can assure Honorable Ngezi that for this financial period and the next financial years, we have budgeted in line with our future liabilities. I think that's about it, Chair. Thank you.
Just before I hand over to the acting DG, there was a question raised by Honorable Zuma on whether we follow up on our trainees once they are trained. I think at this stage, Chair, our approach was our beneficiaries, 67% of them don't have skills, and we give them the necessary skills and trust that the skills that they are receiving will take them far. So we'll monitor them up to the point where they have a workplace exposure for 12 months. So that will be the extent of our follow-up. It's training, then we follow them up to 12 months. Then beyond 12 months, we have not really started tracking them. But we've asked GTEC now that they are doing an impact assessment of our lab projects, just to give us an impact assessment on where these projects have taken us. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I think there are two issues that still remain from the question. One is the issue on whether we've outlawed, as a result of the fact that we've outlawed short-term employment, contract employment, and that gives rise to the incidences of claim. In fact, what is reflected in the incidence of claims is essentially that the law allows for limited duration contracts, and therefore these limited duration contracts come to an end which the law allows for, and therefore it gives rise to the kinds of claims that you see. I think the correlation between having outlawed, and I put outlawed in inverted commas, short-term duration contract is not a reflection of what we see in the law, in the amount of claims that we see. In fact, what we see in the amount of claims is that limited duration contracts are allowed where they are applicable, are allowed in relationship to the, so, and where they are reasonable. For example, in seasonal agriculture, the law allows that you have that kind of limited duration contract, and therefore there's an extension to the claim process. So that's the one point that I thought I needed to make clear. The second issue is in relationship to the domestic workers and the exclusion from COIDA. The fact that has been raised, and it has been accentuated by the ILO's Convention on Domestic Workers, and it gave rise to the amendment that we currently have, that is actually currently sitting now in the cabinet committee for approval to go to cabinet. Whether we've taken 25 years, it's a function of where we are and in our history, where they've been excluded, and therefore we need to deal with this matter as a matter of urgency and go on. I think the constitutional case is just a practicality that we need to go to in relationship to whether they are covered in terms of the current legislation or not. So, we are open and we are willing to change the process and the inclusion of domestic workers and the coverage of the COIT legislation. Those are the two issues. But the last issue that I probably just want to add in relationship to the TERS, temporary employer relief scheme, and the notion that that unions were not in favour of this. We must agree from the outset, Chair, that there has been structural problems with this. It's the lateness of its application, the lateness of its response, the fact that when companies need this relief scheme and the process that we take in terms of getting to the relief that is required used to take inordinate amount of time. By the time that the company, that the money is transferred to the company, the company is normally has gone under by the time we've addressed this in the TERS process. We hope that where we are now, we are working towards achieving the objectives of the TERS scheme in a quick and response to the plight of the company at that point in time.
No, thank you very much. I think from my side and acting DG, and the commissioner, I want the department to look into this, which I find it a bit, I lack a word, I don't want to say it's an anomaly. I'm raising this in terms of page 49, the breakdown of claims, the age group. You remember that Stats SA, when it talks about unemployment, the age group, it starts from 15 years. Now, just simple, a person may say also, those that are 15 years old, which in terms of the constitution, they are children, are supposed to be at school, but in terms of Stats SA, so yourselves, maybe ourselves, when the Stats SA is here, we'll have to raise this. I know there's an ILO convention agreement in terms of age, those that are legal fundies, I see the MA director is looking at me, but it's just a common, if you look into this, and the Stats SA is saying, and that's the bulk of number of people that are said to be unemployed. When you come to claims in terms of CCMA, I'm sorry, in terms of UIF, Akubafuman, so that's why I'm saying, I'm not saying it must be responded now, acting DG, but it's something that I have picked up. And in fact, we are going to, I want to, to have to be raised with the state and say exactly what is it. Because even that, they are not categorizing it. That where is that? They may be employed, but where are they? Where? Is it us? Is it farming? So it's not for now, but is the homework that I am giving you, because precisely that, and it, I know State SA falls under M&E, so move away from silo mentality, look into issues that are cutting across. I thought I would close with that for this presentation. It's quite something which is very interesting, and we'll have to look into it and tackle it and check. I don't know what this SA is going to say, but definitely, as an activist, I'm going to trace that.
Just as a matter of course, we are engaging SA in relationship to how they define employment and unemployment in the country. We're looking at three different areas. The notion of unemployment. How do we define unemployment and employment in the country so that we have a clearer picture? State SA uses the ILO definition and the broader definition of the, and that's the standard definition that's used across the world. So we're engaging State SA in terms of this notion of the need that we also need to address, not in employment, education, or training. We've got to address that notion as well. Yeah.
No, thank you very much, Chair. Now we will then hand over. I don't know whether the tea is, if the tea is not here, is tea ready? Can we just get a leg stretch for tea so that we get the forces from CCMA? I was listening to a phone-in program on compensation of domestic workers. Quite interesting how people have responded. And I was asking myself that if I'm employed by Mr. Baker,
I'm employed by you.
who puts conditions of who puts in conditions of employment to me? Mm-hmm. It's you.
Mm-hmm.
It's you who's going to tell me that in my house you are going to do this, you are going to, and if I don't want to do it, what do you say?
Mm-hmm.
So I must go.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm raising that because I think the issue of saying the community radio stations, when they do the empower communities, is going to be very important. Because it seems as if people are not aware that a house is a private property. So a person who is working in my house is working in my private property. And an inspector comes and knock and say, I've come for inspection. I didn't call you. I mean, that's it. I didn't call you to come and inspect my house whatsoever. So I think it's really something that I think at some time when dust has settled a bit, I don't know whether it will ever settle in the compensation fund, is that they must then come and, because it's a space that is a bit emotive, that of domestic workers. And at times we ask questions as if we are not employers, because we are employers, and we are employers that are putting conditions of service. But I think at a particular time, it was quite interesting. I'm not going to say anything about the response of unions. I was a bit, this thing of being a former trade unionist at times, it makes you to say, oh, okay. But I think it was quite the only thing is that it was on SAFM. It should then go down to community radio stations so that our people and use the language that our people will then in various areas teach. I was then trying to get everybody's attention so that we will then allow the commission, the director of the CMA, to take us through. Over to you, sir.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, members of the committee, my colleagues at the Department of Employment and Labour. Chairperson, I have serious difficulties resisting what just happened. I mean, I was doing my best. Not to respond to that because it is a matter of serious national interest. As the CCMA, especially after the national minimum wage, we are confronted by very interesting legal questions relating to the domestic worker. Because it is, it's not on the screen. I think this is a good opportunity for me to talk about that while the slide is not on the screen. Mm-hmm. But Chairperson, you touched on something that I have serious passion about. Oh, okay, thank you. Children and their dogs and all of those things. And laws of this country are designed not to categorize when it comes to protection. It covers that because that's an employee. Section 185, Section 186 covers that. So the second problem that you have, especially at the introduction of the national minimum wage, is to teach domestic workers about what their rights are in terms of the new law, national minimum wage, and the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. What becomes more interesting is the application of the Employment Equity, but I leave that. But because we are in a season, Chairperson, almost every day, if not second day, we do get notices of retrenchment, even yesterday. Four big companies, big numbers. The expected retrenchments in the domestic worker environment also was expected to rise because of the minimum wage affordability issue. What you find also employers now, what they do, they refer cases and wanting to approach the minister, but they don't understand the something called exemptions. And the technical problem that I'm raising there is that while you're applying for exemptions, so the views of the domestic must be heard when you talk to them about such issues. But that's a different issue. The other problem that you have with Section 189 on a domestic worker, because if you're using the principle of affordability and others, and you're retrenching, part of the Section 189 process is that for me to meaningfully engage in consultation, I must be given information, including financials. So the interesting debate that arises is that so, if I say I retrench you 189.3 notice, and therefore for me to talk to you about whether you can afford me, so you must give me your financial statement. Now the new debate is, can I give you my financial statement, which I see as private, but they are not for the domestic because she is being retrenched. So you must answer the question. So which one applies? So if you say it's private, but it's the very reason why you're retrenching me, so the procedure and substantive fairness of that dismissal becomes a question that I could not engage in because I did not have the information. The other problem we have is that of organizing. A large portion of them are not organized. And they're the most vulnerable in terms of representation on these complex questions, because you can't expect domestic workers to do so. So when we get the new jurisdiction at the CCMA, it's not just limited to national minimum wage, it's also about certain aspects of the basic conditions, and that brings this into the question. So while you may have mentioned that, Chairperson, as in passing, but we're sitting with a serious problem, that a sector that is almost essential, because when a domestic worker does not come to work, the house is disrupted. It's an essential service. So there's a case to be made, but if you raise that now, there's a constitutional right to strike, but one person can't strike. That brings a new interesting question, whether they can mobilize the block to strike. That's a different issue, and which one is the workplace. So it's an interesting paper to talk about. It's not a simple issue, but it's something that is most significant because of the role that they play, the nature of the function. Because you can just ask, Chairperson, all of us sitting here, how many of us have domestic workers? What are we paying them? And to what extent are we complying with the basic conditions of other employment law as defined? Because we must be exemplars, because we can't talk about it and act different. So if you do an audit, whether we're paying the minimum wage, that's an interesting question also, or there's ones we've dismissed because of the management of the minimum wage. So I know where my bread is buttered, I won't ask you, I'm just talking about you. Not really complex question.
I like that.
So I will not do that. So Chairperson, I thought that just to talk about that, because that's an interesting mandate that we have. What you've mentioned, you've touched something very important that actually says we must, when we're talking about recession, we're talking about all these factors that are causing retrenchments and dismissals, we forget that that sector exists. That is also part of that labor market we're talking about. So we're talking protection they must be interpreted included in that protection. When we develop guidelines, when we develop codes and all of that, we mustn't forget that they exist. There's a reason why there's a selection of domestic worker, farmers, and also the public works employees. There's a reason for that, because they are a section that requires protection. So it's a challenge also to organize labor, but I think as I was telling CCMA yesterday, as we're launching our new strategy, one of the things that I said, I think that we have forgotten our character on who we are and how we conduct and treat others. We must go back to that character, Ubuntu and all of that, and also in the drafting of our laws, because we must exemplify in doing that. Chairperson, it's just a, it was just a very good advertiser that you raised. I thought it was have an interest in that as an institution, that we must do so. Chairperson, when we started, the Deputy Minister of Labour said the circumstances were operating under calls for a certain type of leadership because of the circumstances that we found ourselves in. And that's what we are attempting to do, because you will see in the performance that these factors do have a direct impact on the performance of the institution, but it requires a certain type of employee and leadership to be able to survive. So the principle we're trying to preach is a principle that says, let's learn how to do more with less. That's the principle. The difficulty to implement. But I will show the impact of that in the presentation. Chairperson, I will, with your permission, I will focus on the problem areas, not to talk about what we've achieved in terms of quarter two, because it's in the report. I will proceed to slide number two. Slide number two, you will see that for the quarter in question, we did not achieve three targets only. And the explanation of that is contained in slide number six. The others, Chairperson, are just comparatives. The quarter in the previous financial year, all of that, so it's of no significance for purposes of the review and oversight on the quarter in question. So slide number six, Chairperson, it's, if you look at these three, they are very complex targets. They are statutory targets, except one. The first one, which is corrected in the further quarter that we're going to report about the future. It was purely a question of cancellation by the people of Ubuntu Train. We were supposed to do 19.9 and we did 7. And you will see, Chairperson, when we talk about the budget also, just that I don't want to be attracted to talk about the current budget, but just as at that time. But the budget cut has an impact on the performance of that function, directly. But at that time, while we're trying to implement measures to manage costs, the timing that we did that training was not the best, because it was in December, so. And then the people we ought to have trained cancelled. And then it was too late to do it for that quarter. Let us admit, Chairperson, the fault on our part, which I've corrected with the team, that when you set these type of targets, when there are dependencies, because for this target to be achieved, you are dependent on the respondents you're calling to the training. If they cancel, there's nothing you can do. You can't achieve that. So if we had located the date for that performance comfortably within the quarter, not in the last month of the quarter, if there's such cancellations, you're able to recover by continuing to do other trainings other than those that you targeted. So it's an outright admission on behalf of the team. We could have done that better in as far as the timing of the training is concerned. But training material, the commissioners involved, everything else was done until in the last minute there was cancellation. So that's the only reason why we have not achieved that time. So we corrected it. Except with the entire training team at the end of that quarter, they accounted to me correctly what happened. And then now as we speak, it's corrected, and the trainings and the timings, all of that is in place. So that's what that is. The second and very difficult target is that every case that we receive must be heard within 30 days. We can see we're sitting at 98%, and we're talking thousands and thousands of those chapters. We are trying our best to, with the limited resources, to better that. But I can tell you now, one of the things we agreed to do, what we're trying to do, improving our case management system. We've launched a new app which assists in terms of people inquiring about information, and the increasing number of commissioners for us to be able to deal with the caseload. And you can see you're talking about 65,000 of those cases. When we say first event, let me just explain probably to others who may not understand what it means. The first thing that must happen, there must be a conciliation once the matter is referred. That's the first event. So if there's a deferment or the matter does not happen, it proceeds to the next stage, then that's the next event. So, but the target is that at first event, we must be able to hear the matter within 30 days upon receipt. So you can see the extent of what we've achieved in doing that. We just missed just a few, less than 2%. But also must explain, legally speaking, that even if it's not conciliated within 30 days, the matter is not closed or doesn't end. It proceeds to the next stage, which will be arbitration. If not jurisdictional, it can be arbitrated. It will proceed to the labor court. So while we understand and accept a person that it has to be 100%, but that's the reason for us not to be able to do so. It's also about the number of commissioners that we have, because I can tell you, Chairperson, now, you will see in the later quarters, the budget cut has materially and severely affected us. So you'll see if I will talk about that. Therefore, we have very few commissioners, those that we use to achieve that target, they are fully stretched to the limit. I can show you our wellness report. We're pushing very hard to make sure that while we have those limitations, but social justice and service to people comes first. And that's why we've stretched ourselves to the limit. I also do cases sometimes to add to the muscle for us to do this. I'm not supposed to, but I have to because of those principles of social justice and giving our people service. So I make time and sit, conciliate and arbitrate and do all of that. CFO is not a commissioner, so she can't do that. So that's the essence of that target. There's nothing bad, there's nothing wrong. The case just moves into the next stage. But because the statutory purpose of doing conciliation is to make sure that you mediate, you conciliate the case before it gets to arbitration. If it's not done within 30 days, at least you don't have the benefit of that. But also, it's not all lost, because even at arbitration, with the consent of parties, you can still conciliate the case, even if you did not conciliate in the first stage. So from the prejudice point of view, it's zero. But it's appearing here has not achieved, because it's supposed to be 100%, which means every one of those thousands of those cases must be done within that period. That's all it means. It's a high-quality performance issue. It's not negligence or anything else. Just to give comfort to the members. That's what it means. The last one, it's the awards. by law, when a case is concluded, the commissioner must ensure that the award is issued to parties within 14 days. So you can see Chairperson was sitting at 99.6, audited to that. So there's few that we that has fallen into the cracks. And the reason that I gave for number two is exactly the same reason for that one. Sometimes it's just an error of the case management officer for not sending out the award on time. To the satisfaction of members, let me explain how this works. Is we do not wait until the 14th day. We've got internal systems that we've developed. So the commissioner will then issue an award on the 10th day. It goes through a process, what we call a perusal system. That's where we do the validation, where we do the authentication. That's where we test if it is an enforceable award and all of that. Once it passes that test of the certain changes that need to be made, then the perusal will, another commissioner, will then write notes on what needs to be looked at, and then it sends back to the commissioner, and the commissioner will then make corrections and then send it back to the case management officers on the 14th or the 13th day. Then it is issued to parties. This is what we are talking about on that tablet. Again, it is a systems issue. Our original plan, which we are now struggling to do, was the ICT investment, where we invest on our case management system, we invest in our ICT, so that we can be able to show you and give you 100% and increase commissions, but we can't afford it. It's even worse now in the new budget when there's almost 30 million rand cut from less allocation over and above that. So you'll see when we present our budget before the committee the extent of that and the huge impact it's going to have on our performance moving forward. It doesn't look good because of that. So from the performance point of view, Chairperson, the strain that you see, you'll see in the later quarters also, our case is increasing at an alarming rate at the moment. If there's anything more than just ordinary cases, if there's anything that we hope to do, is to increase the pool of commissioners that deal with Section 189A, the large-scale dismissal, because those ones are coming thick and fast. We need to capacitate more so that we can assist the country to at least mitigate the number of people who suffer retrenchments and not contribute to the unemployment rate. That's all, Chairperson, in as far as what we have not performed. Technically, that should be where our report ends, but I want to proceed to slide number 11. The slides that come after is the connection of what we do and how it fits in into the overall outcomes of government. So I will not waste time on it because it's always there. That one. I want to proceed to slide 11. This dashboard. We had a plan to have a much better improved dashboard that gives you live stats and all of that, but we can't afford it, so we're not doing it. We're sticking to the old. There's just three or four parts that I just want to highlight. The first one on the left-hand side, the second on the left-hand side, that's the average days it takes us to deal with these 30 days I spoke about earlier, the average of 23 days to deal with conciliations. Now, with less resource and high rising cases, we may have problems with that moving forward, especially in the new financial year. So I can stretch my team to a certain point. But at the moment, we are strained. You may have seen also when we advertised positions for commissioners. we stopped full-time commissioner appointments. We're only doing part-time because we can't afford them. I think we advertised 2 weeks ago. Because when it comes to part-time, they're like independent contractors. We can control their time when we can use them. But a full-time one, when they're there, even if they're not doing, you still have to pay them. So for us, it's about productivity, it's about quality, about delivery. So, especially the new budget, that aspect of 23 days, because of the stretch that we're talking about, is going to suffer significantly. And then, the other one, what I spoke to about earlier on about domestic workers and all of that, it's what we call the Know Your Rights. You see on the right-hand side, the second one, says 23,262 people are capacitated. That's what we do. We do the capacitation training, and most of them with assessment, because we must try to resist the temptation of training people without testing to understand what you taught them. Because from training must go to application. So with the budget challenge that we have, we've adopted a new approach. In fact, I should have mentioned also on the 30-day one, on the conciliation one. We've developed a product where we're calling it the pre-conciliations. Pre-conciliation is when you conciliate a case through a telephone, when parties don't come to the hearing. That has many advantages. One of them is that, and largely it's your domestic workers that we do those cases to. The complex ones, we prefer to have them in front of us. Domestic workers, farm workers, you know, that category. So the commissioner will pick up the phone and phone both parties and say, let's resolve this. So without necessarily making any decision, you can't arbitrate like that. Unless you do it the way we wanted to do it in terms of our improved ICT system, where commissioner can arbitrate from anywhere. Doesn't have to be in a hearing room like this one. We had thought of doing that where parties don't travel. Yeah, the benefits. It's also a contributor to the cost containment also, but still achieving high quality performance. So when you phone, once it's settled, then the settlement agreement is signed. So the matter is resolved, they don't have to come. The advantage is that there's no transfer, you know, transport costs, there's no all of those things. Because some of our cases are not done because people can't afford to come to hearing rooms. That is offensive to social justice. We can't encourage that. So this method helps because you can talk to them from wherever they are at. And then the capacitation, including the outreach, which is at the top there where you've got two hands. These are outreach programs, both of them. If there's any area that we really like to do, it's this one. Usually the direct impact of the two, it increases our caseload because people understand the rights more and therefore they come to our hearing and they raise cases. Sometimes it's cases that are out of time. And they have to apply for condemnations and sometimes they don't know how to apply for condemnations and they get dismissed because of lack of knowledge and information. We have to collectively, in an integrated way, find a way of not letting that happen. It's not just us. When we present budget, Jefferson will bring other progressive methods that we've thought about, what we need to use. And for us to do so, we will call for help, first with our parent company, Department of Employment and Labor, for us to achieve that, for accessibility. And you will see also when you present the budget that some of the offices where we have leases and leased buildings, because we can't afford them, we have to close them. Because we can't afford them. Non-renewals and not creating new offices for accessibility for people. Mm-hmm. So that's a problem. The next one, Chairperson, which I think is important, is the one that's written jobs on the right-hand side, the third. The method here is that and I'm raising this issue as a concern also, Chairperson, that we know that there's a difference between 189 and 189A. 189A is large-scale dismissals, those are the big ones, like the one we got yesterday. And the cases we're talking about is those ones, the large-scale ones, on that 42%. So in the quarter in question, we're looking at people who were facing loss of jobs was 22,559. And through our facilitation, we managed to save 9,559. The number could be bigger with resource. What you don't see is the Section 189, the ordinary ones, not the large-scale ones. We don't report on those because we're not approached on those ones. But the reality that I'm raising is that the fact that the 189As are referred to us does not mean that 189 retrenchments don't happen. They do happen. So we're not reporting about them because they're not within our range. So we've set the target of 35% that we must achieve on the number of jobs we save using our commissioners to facilitate. But we achieved the 42% in doing that function. If there's anything that makes us proud, it's that one. Because this translates to the triple crisis directly. Because we are very clear in our minds that one job saved is one family saved, and all other dependents that comes with it. And if we're to alleviate the recession issues and all of that, this is one function we need to put resources on. So it's not just one, so we saved 9,000 so far. That's just up to that point. The number is much bigger if you look at the other quarters also. So this, for us, if you read Chapter 1, Section 1 of the Act, LFA, when it talks about social justice principles and objects of the LFA, this one goes directly into that. So what we don't want to do, Chairperson, is when it comes to the capacity and budget that we have now, this also is going to be affected in terms of capacity for us to do that. So that, Chairperson. So from the performance point of view, Chairperson, that's our report. I don't want to spend time on others because they are also affected in a way, but you will see also, if you look on strike on the left-hand side, the second from the bottom, out of, we settled about 78%. These are public interest matters, your strikes. 36 out of 46 is what we've managed to intervene and resolve. Why is it important? It's because the LRA says we must achieve labor peace. And when we engage with parties, we find mutual beneficial solution in all the interventions we've done. Out of the 46 that we involved in, 36 of that we managed to resolve. There's no target in the annual performance plan. This is what we do in terms of our statutory mandate to intervene in terms of Section 150. We recall, Chairperson, that Section 150 of the LLA was amended to include more power for us to intervene in matters that are of national importance and having a direct impact on the labour market. So if you're talking economic development in the LRA, if you're talking labour peace and the protections, that's what we've achieved there. So every one of those achievements connects not only to the Act, but it connects to the outcomes of government. That also includes cases of employment equity. Chairperson, just one point on the matters of employment equity. If there's any function that we do that connects directly to the Constitution, it's the Employment Equity Act, because it's born out of the Equality Clause, Section 9 of the Constitution. And if you look at the principles in the preamble, it will show you that that's a very important function to do. So we have a special panel, people specially trained, very well trained, to do the type of work. In closing that chapter, the overall problem that we're sitting with, which is an important aspect, which requires a very serious integration and a collaborated function, is that of enforcement. You see, the department does enforcement through the enforcement department, which is the Executive Department. The Act still provides that people can go to the department and come to us, but all the outcomes that come from there, they must be enforced. And I've raised this also in the workshop, Chairperson, that there are gaps, very serious gaps, in the enforcement process. That includes the domestic we spoke about, the farm workers we spoke about, and all of that. So that's very important. If you're talking the effectiveness of the legislation, you can only see it in the outcomes being executed, not made. We have a gap there. We had intended to create a very strong and powerful enforcement division under our legal department. We can't afford to pay to create those functions. We're using about 4 people now to do the enforcement cases, which is also spread in the different regions for us to make sure that the numbers of the awards we issue that are enforced. I've raised the issue of the labor court, the capacitation of the labor court in terms of the courts, in terms of the judges, because we can't afford to have cases that last between 3 to 7 years to conclude to the court. It can't happen. We shouldn't do that. I know that there's remedies in law, but there are other things which I don't want to talk about now because it will take time. But the effectiveness of enforcement of awards is all highly dependent on the effectiveness of the labor court. That's where cases go. Our primary concern is that when users don't get joy, they come back to the system. So, but you issue this award, so what do I do? Because the employer is refusing to enforce. And when you test to see there's a review involved, we can't go beyond that. You end up sending them to the pro bono office of the labor court for them to be assisted. But we can't have that. I'm raising it directly again, Chairperson, at the risk of repeating myself. We can't have thousands of awards lingering unenforced, because those are workers' awards that are remaining idling. Some reviews, they just rot in court. Representation disappears. A worker disappears in the wilderness, you don't know what happens to them. We can't have that. We have to find a way to deal with it. But our resources are limited, so we can't take it, you know them. So, Chairperson, you call me out of order if I, on the issue of the budget issue, because I will take it. But at some point, we need to make an assessment question on the impact of limited budgets in terms of terms of the performance of Waikato. We've got to make that assessment. And also the prioritization also, because the prediction we have now in the new financial year, if I look at the report in quarter two, is going to look different because of that. You'll start seeing it in the third quarter that we'll be reporting in and moving forward. So OCFO will speak, Chairperson, but there's nothing to report on finance other than the overall variance of 2% that the CFO will talk about, and then also the status of our enforcement of the HS findings. That's our report, Chairperson. One of the things that's going to become important, which we are trying to do, is just because of the budget issue, the elevation of the role of language and culture in dispute resolution. The role of language and culture in dispute resolution. Coupled with that was our plan to at least, you know, make this historic achievement of opening our CCM offices together with our sister department in the townships. There's no law or policy that says we can't do that. I don't know why we're not doing it. So we had planned to do so, and if resources allow, they don't at the moment. We want to do that. So the issue of language and culture, Chairperson, is important. If you look at the role or the number of cases we're talking about, one thing that I've learned doing a mediation and a conciliation in a case is how important language is in resolving a dispute. Because the parties are grieved when you speak to them in the language of their choice. They understand you better than through translation. And you cannot separate language from culture and custom. Yesterday, I was addressing the entire CCMI, commissioners and staff. I said, as we start the new financial year, what is primary is that all of the 11 languages of that is in the Constitution, it must be used. When we mediate where it is practicable, we must use the language that parties understand. Because sometimes, Chairperson, we find it very strange. The commissioner will tell his cause, the representative from HR will tell his cause, and the aggrieved will tell his cause, but the process runs in English. There's something mentally wrong about that. And sometimes, when you fail to resolve a dispute, it's not because the party is refusing, it's because they don't understand you. When you switch the language and you act in accordance with the protocols of culture of the person you're talking to, you resolve the dispute. That's the attitude of constitutionalism we must do in our processes. The day must come where you will find there's an award done in Sizulu. Whoever does not understand will be translated. If we don't do that, the only reason why we have not done it and why it's not done in court, there's only one reason given usually. I think we spoke about it in the workshop. It's the cost issue. It's too expensive to do that. But I have the belief, and I'll keep talking about it every opportunity I get, there's a direct link between the issues of language and culture into dispute resolution. If we're going to talk for IR, the mistake that we make is to think that the fourth industrial revolution is about technology only. It's not. It is also about the change of attitude, the creativity, you know, the softer skills and certain approaches and all of that. That's a full course. But we've got to do that. But our new strategy, as you will hear, Chairperson, is about reviving such things for us to try a different method of resolving disputes, and that's what we're encouraging. So, I hope I was not out of order. That was quarter two report. That was quarter two report. So, it's just there's these things that, because we're sitting in the fourth quarter now, there's these things that also overlap. I don't want to raise them, but I know they arise from the build-up towards them. But as far as quarter two, there are no alarm bells. I hope, Chairperson, we have accounted why we have not achieved that. target we spoke about. CFO,
Let's hand over to the CFO.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning to the honourable members. I think the director has already touched on the financial position of the organisation overall. On the overall allocated budget that we have for the financial year, up until quarter two, we had 524 million to spend. Of that 524 million, we've spent 515, which gives us the overall variance of only 2% of the money that we couldn't spend for that particular quarter. Our main issues around our spending is mainly emanating from case disbursement, which is our core delivery model that we use in delivering the work that we have to do. Because as a CCMA, how we actually deliver the mandate that we have to use human resources in delivering that particular mandate. So we use both full-time and part-time commissioners to do the work that we do. And because the part-time commissioner specifically is a variable cost that we can contain and manage as and when we need to use it and how to release it into delivering our mandate, that's where we have leverage to actually try and supplement or deal with the caseload that we actually have as we see the numbers keep on increasing. So the pressures that we are actually seeing in our numbers overall is we are constantly increasing that number or the utilization of our part-time commissioners because now we have to respond to the cases that are actually coming through our doors and making sure that we still do deliver services. I think what is important, Chairperson, and you actually start seeing it as we report in quarter three and quarter four and in the new financial year, we now have to play a very tactful game in responding to the work that we do, because there might be a point in time where we are actually not even able to do the measures that we are currently doing, because now the resources that we have as an organization and the work that we have to do, they are no longer balancing at all. The work that we have to do is very high, whereas the resources that we have, it's not even going closer to meeting the work that we have to do. So it's really putting a pressure on us and strain on us, and you will see it right through our numbers. If you look at slides 13 and 14, that are the two slides that actually tells you exactly the strain that we have as an organization, because slide 14, it tells you exactly how we do case disbursement, which is our commissioner work, and where we actually are at the current moment. I think overall on the financials is there. I'll also touch briefly on slide 17, which is the 80 findings that we had. For the financial year 18-19, we had 17 findings in total. As at end of quarter two, 9 of them were resolved. 7 of them, we were still addressing them, implementing internal controls in line with the recommendations from the AG. And then there was only one finding that we couldn't resolve, because by the time the finding was actually picked up, for us to do any implementation to resolve it immediately, it was too late. This is with regards to compliance on the BEE certificate and compliance. So for the new financial year, for 1920, we started processes to actually correct it, but for the financial year of 1819, it was very too late for us to deal with it because of the compliance issue and it's a historic matter. I think overall it's that chapter.
No, thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Director. Members, there is the presentation. Any questions? Honorable Bikram, Honorable Gavan, Honorable Dabe, in that order.
Thank you for the opportunity and thank you for the report. I did report once back to you, Mr. Director, about I went in on an oversight, which you allowed me to come and have a look and speak to the staff, both in Cape Town and Johannesburg. And what I noticed is that the staff are actually tired. They are overworked, each one told me this. They don't get tea time, not because you told them they can't have, but they can't cope with the work. And most of them are not getting lunch. Most of them are also working beyond 5 o'clock. I don't know how that's going to, because people are going to burn out at some stage. and maybe your financial situation speaks directly to that, and it might be something that you need to look into. I'm not sure how long that's going to survive for, quite frankly, and my feeling was that people are starting to feel ragged. The other thing is that there must be some way in which you could look at gatekeeping. And what I mean by gatekeeping is that the referrals that are coming in, I think in the last financial year you had 200,000 cases, about more or less. This is not taking into account the bargaining council, it's just CCMA. We predict about close on 300,000, because your numbers already are telling you about 25% up. So if you're going to go up to 30% higher and you don't have extra money, I'm not sure how that's going to cope altogether. Maybe you want to comment on that. And if there was some sort of gatekeeping, in other words, I know that when people phone in to report a case, you could actually maybe at that point give advice. Also, when cases come in, I know that you are assessing them very carefully, and you're saying this is out of time or this is not our jurisdiction or whatever, but you can also look at the case and say this is not actually a dispute. And there must be some way in which we could maybe amend the regulations or even the legislation to put in some gatekeeping that might cut down a lot of the frivolous cases. I've been involved in many myself which were actually frivolous, shouldn't have been there. And I, of course, praise the commissioners who are settling cases on the telephone, because I think they're cutting down a lot of the time and effort on that. The other thing that you are doing to your commissioners is that you're setting them down, well, not you, but your regions are setting them down for almost 3 or 4 arbitrations a day, whereas it used to be 1 a day for each commissioner. I don't know, you're not giving the public enough time to do it, and there's pressure on the public as well to, and especially the person who's been dismissed, feels almost pressure not to bring all their witnesses or whatever, and it's creating a problem. And I'm not sure how that could happen. There's also just finally, there's been a call by COSATU to have a very careful look at the cases involving the minimum wage or any wage claims that could then be appealed to the Labour Court. That calls for a definite legislative change. And because that takes, going to the Labour Court would take 2 or 3 years. And I'm a culprit of that myself. Just go and review it or take it on appeal. And the point is that these aren't really judicial decisions. They're more technical decisions. If someone hasn't been paid their leave pay, it's not a judicial decision. You don't have a look at it and say, look, this, you haven't made it, pay it. Then the employer can then take that on to the Labour Court. It doesn't make sense at all. And so maybe you want to comment on that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I have one comment.
No, thank you, Chairperson. One is going to start by welcoming the presentation from the Director, Chair. Chairperson, my question will be on slide 4, on the overall performance of the Commission. When you look at the trend line, Chairperson, in quarter 2 of 2017-18 and quarter 3 and quarter 2 of 18-19, they were sitting at an average of like 90. Now we see a decline here of 63%. So what are the measures they have in place as the entity to turn around the current situation, Chairperson? The second one, Chairperson, is on slide 6.
My question will be in relation to target number one, which is the capacity building intervention that was planned, of which the turnaround was quite very bad. They expected 99 and only 7. there were 9. Oh, okay. So, oh, it's fine, even if there were 9, I'm going to ask this question. So, I want to get an indication or to establish if there were no financial implications in relation to this, because for me, when you prepare for a training or a capacity building activity, you need to do all the necessary logistics, your catering and so forth, material, what not, the venue and what not. So is it not going to affect the performance of the institution financially as far as wasteful and fruitless expenditure is concerned? That's my question. The last one, Chair, is on the slide that was displayed here on the AG findings. There is one remaining finding that is still outstanding, Chair. So when are you planning to resolve this remaining finding, or what are the hindrances? Because my understanding, if there are findings from the AG, you need to have a clear action plan where you monitor it depending on the time frame that you have given yourself as the entity. So when are you planning to resolve this one? The very last one, Chair, is that I see on the, what is this? The dashboard. On the dashboard that they also conduct outreach programs to create awareness to the communities out there, and also to capacitate the communities for them to be able to understand their rights and so forth. But now, what I want to check is that in their priority, do they also target the vulnerable workers, in particular those who are staying in rural communities? Because where I come from, people, they don't understand their rights. They don't even know that there is CCMA. What is their communication strategy that they have in place, Chairperson, as the CCMA? This one, maybe I'm not sure whether the director will be in a position to respond to it, Chair. The one that talks about the retrenchment. In his presentation, he did mention that a LRA only makes a provision for large-scale retrenchment. So what I want to get is that what happens if the people, the workers who are retrenched, they are less than 50? What should be the correct procedure that they should follow? Thank you, Chairperson.
Honorable David.
Thank you, Chair, and let us welcome the presentation. just a clarity on the question of the 29% referrals from the Business Professional Services, slide 7. They seem to be the one who are the most or the highest number of highest percentage of the total referrals. I'm not sure whether the 29% is in relation to 67,000. So maybe on average, what are the real issues around the professional services? Because those you think might be the people who are enlightened in terms of, or is it because of their enlightenedness that creates this challenge? Kodwa sihlalo kukhona njena ebengifisa ukuthi mhlawumbe uma ngabe ngemvume yakho ungangilekelela mhlawumbe umuntu akabe nengoyazana nje encane eceleni no-director mhlawumbe ngenzeka kube khona abanye abafisa ukujoyina kodwa bengifisa uma ngabe kungenzeka hhayi namhlanje
Honorable
Yinan. Thank you very much. My question to you, Director, relates to what you said, but not on this presentation, about the minimum wage. That since it was introduced, your expectation was a 10% increase of the disputes, but surprisingly it was threefold than that, to the extent that the CCMA is doing mostly what the department was supposed to be doing. My question related to that is how do you deal with that problem, because currently there are many people that need to have their cases resolved. But if they ended up in your desk in that multitude, how do you do it? And what is the other option? Because that gives the confirmation, therefore, that the CCMA is overloaded with the work, with the little number of personnel that it takes. Then how do you do it? What is the other alternative? Thank you.
I just want to check. In fact, is it not about time now that as CCMA you give us the number of cases that are gathering dust in labor courts? My understanding is that each province has got a labor court, and where is this? How many in this province? How many in that province? And in that also, which sectors are more? I'm raising this question. Oh, the other information that we need is also about the awards. Which sectors? Is it the domestic sector? Is it the, I'm raising this because we can't afford now. We are always blamed that for 20 years we've not been doing this. We're in the 25th year of our. It's about time now that we, in my view, we stop being general. We so that we are able to correct and be able to. If we are allowed to do that, to name and shame them. When people are listening on us debating, they must get facts. That's my question for you. That is it protocol wise? If it's not allowed, then I think as honorable members we will know what to do. But can we get that now? And I'm requesting that if we can get it, we get it before we go far earlier, before we prepare for our budget vote. Because we can have a situation where we're talking about employment. There are employers that one, well, the issue of retrenchment, you have to also have an understanding which sectors and whatever, but awards, which are to be enforced, people are just not prepared. So that thing, we are pouring, we're talking about something that people are just looking to us and saying, let them talk, we're not going to talk. So I think my question is to you as the head of the institution, is that is it possible for us to get that information? Yeah. I think that's...
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks to members for the questions. Let me start with the wellness one. It's not just my staff that is trained, my executive and myself as well. That is a fact. And Chairperson, I can say it here without any doubt that if there's anything that gives me pride in leading the institution, is to have the type of staff we have, especially commissioners who say, we know why we're created. We know the service we give is a public service. We will do what we can to make sure it's achieved. It is correct that staff's, what you described, is real. I can share with you, Chairperson, our wellness report, because I initiated the wellness report just to see how well is our institution. Because the one thing that we can't afford to do, that in pursuit of performance, that the staff collapses. Because that's wellness. But the attitude is what keeps us going, and what keeps our commissioners going, is when you look at those cues that are there. Because if I'm going to complain about fatigue, and I'm tired, and I'm postponing lunch, and we all do that. There's no one is exempted. But the pursuit is driven by the people that we see and the circumstances that they're in compared to where we are at. I'm one of those that are guilty of that, because I always preach to our team and I say that when somebody leaves their home and coming to the CCMA, they're coming there but they're carrying one thing, and that is hope. That's all they have. Some of them don't even reach our offices. So when you see, there's a comparator. You have to look at somebody who's employed, like everybody here. How many of our people who receive salary cannot even end the month with still having the income they earn at the end of the month? Some can hardly finish a month with a salary. And you look at what they pay for with that salary. It includes one of the most basic rights you have to give to any individual in terms of any constitution of the world, that children must still go to school, must pay for them, they must clothe them, must feed them. They need to have a house, a roof over their head. And once the income is lost, it means everything else that was dependent on that is gone. So, if I'm going to complain about fatigue, why am I complaining when there's somebody who is a fellow citizen that is coming to me with hope to help, that I don't help? So if I close the door and said, I'm too tired, come back next week, they don't even have money to come there, because some of them walk to the hearing rooms, kilometers amongst them. Coming, they're hungry, but their problem is not their hunger, it's the hunger of those that they represent that they left at home. They get letters of eviction, cars are being repossessed, there's no grocery, there's no money for school. So I do a comparator when I talk to CCMA staff, and I say, so which one of the two devils do we choose for? Because as you live here, you have a home, your family is provided for. But the law and the constitution says this is what we must do for our people. That's what drives us, more than anything else. But it does not mean that we are not fatigued, because we are. It doesn't mean that we don't work for those hours. We do. But it is a question of choice because of the constitutional conviction of achieving social justice. That's what drives us. If you read chapter 1 of the LRA, if there's anything that is important, is that social justice concept. You see, what is difficult sometimes is that the practitioners and consultants and unions and everybody, whenever they talk about social justice, they think it's just a fancy legal term. It's a socio-economic concept, that one. It has to do with the social and economic standing of people wanting to achieve what our constitution is trying to achieve. So in pursuit of that mandate, our wellness is affected. It's even worse now. The scenario that you painted of one commissioner, four cases, sometimes it's more than four that the commissioner does. The system that we're reviewing now because of the cost containment is, there's a roll call we do, and we visited Johannesburg. There's a roll call there where a commissioner will be given a case, but you'll have four on in his name. What the limited resources are starting to do is to erode on the quality output. Because if you have four cases to do, there's a certain way you should be doing your mediation and conciliation, giving it time, allow storytelling, try to resolve the dispute without going to arbitration. But because of that pressure, then it gets affected. Eventually, some of these cases are not done because on the day, we are unable to cover all of them. But when they stay over the time, you should try not to send anybody back to do the case. That's the reason. So, is there a solution other than resources? There isn't. Our plan was to invest on technology to make sure that some of these processes were making them easier without overloading, because we can. But we don't have that resource. We're still doing the old traditional way. That's the load. Are we able to cope with it? No, we're not. We're not. All I have that remains is the heart of those commissioners to do the matter, nothing else. Yesterday I announced to them exactly that. I said, your budget has been significantly cut. I can't take more commissioners anymore because you can't afford them. So it means you have to do more than what you want, which should be more than what you see in that number. The alternative to that is to do the gatekeeping that you're talking about. You have to say, well, it's a positive way. I'll talk to that. But the problem with gatekeeping, I'll just match that point to this one. The problem with gatekeeping is that the system of employment law and our referral system that we have is not the same system that you find in court where you're dealing with pleadings, where you're able to see the case of the applicant. The time you can know what the case is or what case to meet is when evidence is led. But it's not in all cases. There are cases that shouldn't be there. There are cases that are out of jurisdiction that should not be referred to us. There are cases where somebody really, they allege dismissal, but they were never dismissed. But the problem is doing that prior to evidence process is quite difficult. There are those that we can do. That system is very important. But to do that too, I still need commissioners to do that. And when they need commissioners to do that, they must pay them. And that's what I don't have. That's the reality of it. And the minimum wage review, in every conference I present in, if there's anything that I preach is exactly what you just raised. I do not think it is constitutionally correct, broadly speaking, that when an employer, let's take a domestic worker, you are supposed, well, just let's take the 20 rand amount. So you have not paid 20 rand. And then there's a compliance order issued by the department. And then there's no compliance. Because that's the society that we are calling a system in that we must be revived to understand our constitutional obligation. That even if there's no prospect in the case, why are you reviewing it? Others are doing just to delay the case until somebody dies while waiting for justice. Which that happens. Others give up because they have nowhere to go. They don't know what to do. So minimum wage This is an economic legislation that is intended to create living wage. Some have argued that. I presented the International Conference of Free State and said exactly that. So we have to create, legally speaking, an internal review system that does not go to the labor court. The Australian system, I think two or three countries do that in the research. Because if you're going to take somebody who's owed 2,000 rand on review, they're going to wait for 3 years for 2,000 rand. And it can die there because somebody needs to answer to the review papers that the employer is filing. But you have no union or a lawyer, that matter is dead. But you're owed minimum wage. So if you look at the overall picture of those targeted for minimum wage, it is eaten also by that. Therefore, you can't reach that number. Because one of the factors that makes us not to get there is because of those reviews. So if I were to make a proposition, it's a legislative one, really, because Section 145 is there, there's an award of this that can be reviewed. Only legislation, if I had to make provision that in the regulations or rules, I'll be ultra vires, because I'm providing in the rules what is not provided in statute in terms of the process-wise. I'm creating a new process that is not in the Act. So that requires legislative reform for us to achieve that. That's why I'm raising it here, because I've raised in the workshop and I've raised it everywhere else that we can't have minimum wage dispute and awards issued in terms of that at the labor court. The recent example that you have read is the SPA one. We've issued an award that SPA, you're owing 12 million rand because you have not paid the minimum wage. It comes from the compliance order that they did not do. And what is it that we get? It's going to the labor court. All the beneficiaries of that 12 million rand must wait, which might take 3 to 5 years, depending, of course, on the issues of raising. So the beneficiaries of the minimum wage in that case ought to get the minimum wage back pay and payment moving forward. But it's stagnant now because the matter is pending at the labor court. Alternatively, in terms of this model, we'll be doing that internally. We'd have set it down by now already. Would not waste time. 10 days down, we would be set down. Put two commissioners or three and said, resolve the matter. The decision is final. There's no review lying outside that.
Can I request, Director, that in responding, try and so that you don't.
I'm out of order. I apologize. I apologize.
One,
I apologize.
To the chair, but two, try and so that you don't run the risk of representation.
I apologize. I sometimes forget to listen. I apologize.
I know you are passionate about it.
No, I love it. It's very important. Okay. So that's what the proposition is, Shepherdson. I'm asking the portfolio committee to look at the legal reform to protect minimum wage disputes and insulate them against reviews. That's a direct proposition that I'm making in response to. The decline in performance, the slide shows the quarter of the previous year. And what is included in those also is just that it won't give you a proper picture because some of the targets that are not done are annual targets. So they get corrected in the next quarter. And at the end of the year, it also gets corrected. What you will see common is two targets that you referred to in that slide that talks about the statutory amendment, the 30-day issue and the arbitration award. I've given the reasons there. That's a resource issue. Throughout all of those quarters, even annual, you will see it's just those two targets that are running. Other than that, we don't miss targets. It will like annual, you'll see just two targets. But others, they get corrected over quarters. So it may reflect, like now, on the three. It drops from 95 or 75 or so, and it comes to, it's because of that. So there's a formula also used in terms of the number of targets on those lists and the percentage it gives you. But in terms of effect, I can argue it's on the numbers it looks like a decline, but in terms of impact, it remains the same. Eventually it's corrected. But yes, it is a decline in performance because targets were missed. But you will see, I can show in the next presentation, it's the same target because it's almost impossible to achieve 100% on I was within 14 days and 30 day issue. It keeps repeating itself. Yeah, so it repeats that. And also what I must explain, the second one on the 14 days, if you miss one in the first quarter, you miss one target, that one doesn't get corrected. It gets carried until the end of the year. It's a cumulative one. So you can't correct it. Once you miss one, I don't know how many thousands of awards, you miss one, you have not performed. Even if it's 99.9%, you have not met the target. So that's how strict the target is. That's why you see that decline. Okay, on the capacity one, slide six, the financial implications, no. What we do, Chairperson, is there's something we call cost recovery. This is part of the survival methods. That if a company asks us to do training, we ask you to cover the cost of what you're asking us to train you on. It's called cost recovery. We're not making profit. So it's going to cost us $1,000. So we charge $1,000. So we don't have a loss. That's what it helps us also to avoid the fruitless expenditure because we'll be liable for that. If it comes out, the venue is higher, and then you have to pay the food for people that come, so it's fruitless. So that's the best way for us to do that, to avoid that. I'll check if there's others that has fallen into the cracks that does not meet that principle. I will disclose and declare on that this is what transpired. You will see that in our quarter two, we don't have incidents of fruitless and irregular. It's older that we have, but there's because we've got measures in place. So what we're also going to be doing moving forward, I don't want to be long on this one because you caution me, Chair, is that we are going to make a proposal to the department that instead of us hiring venues and spending money, we must create these effective partnerships with state entities and any organ of state and state departments, that if there's a building that belongs to whatever department, and there's space for us to do hearings, instead of paying, we must be allowed to use it for accessibility, because it's spread everywhere, government institutions. If there's space, why can't we use it? It's a matter of data there. But there's no cost, because already it's covered. Those owned by the state and those that, in whatever form, Department of Employment level is the first target, whatever other department. We must adopt that approach for all entities, in my view. That any venue, if the Department of Agriculture has a conference room, we can't hire a conference room from private sector. We must use that one because we don't have to pay for that. They're not saving costs for the issue for austerity measures to adopt it. So that's the approach that we're taking to deal with that aspect. There's a firm proposal that we're making in terms of that. Chairperson, on the HE finding, CFO, I think she has responded on the red one. That is not done. It has been corrected now. It's taken to the governing board. It was the BE certificate issue, which we never understood why we even have to do that in the first place But we've complied with it to the extent that it's understood by Treasury, although we argued against it. But the rest, by the time we report the annual report, they should be sitting at zero. Because that's the only red one. There's no other. So we should be sitting. The dashboard. Do we target vulnerable workers? They are the first priority, the vulnerable workers, in the campaigns and the problems that we do. I'll bring the slide next time that shows in each and every province where we've been and who we've trained. That's the one I said is going to be affected in terms of budget, unless we are successful in the method I spoke about earlier, where the cost is covered. Because if there's no one paying, then we can't do it because we don't have money to do it. That's the only unfortunate thing. The issue, the second problem is accessibility. AgriSA has created new rules and certain systems on how you access farms, even for enforcement and all of that. Even us for training people on the farms, we have to go through that. So we've created a relationship with AgriSA so that we can discuss those things, so that accessibility is. But it's not a CCMA approach. It must be a departmental approach, including the other entities, because compliance-wise, the CCMA, Compensation Fund, UIF, and all of them. It must be an integrated approach. We can't come today, then tomorrow's Compensation Fund, the other day's UIF. You must have one approach that is integrated to deal with that. So the vulnerable sectors, including the domestic and the farms and public works, they are part of that equation. But answering the question directly, vulnerable workers is priority one in what we do. Retrenchment. Let me explain this differently. There's two parts in the Act that is provided for. It's 189A and 189. 189A is where parties have a discretion to refer to us directly to assist in last year dismissal. Those that are below that are not referred to us unless it is in an ordinary dispute where somebody claims unfair dismissal due to operational requirements, that we do those cases. But our approach in discussing that is that the fact that only large scale can be referred in terms of 189A, the dismissals in the normal ones that are below the threshold are happening. There has to be a system that we have to find on how to capture them. We don't have resources to do that or to even approach when those things happen. So we can't afford that. We only deal with what that is referred to. That is as far as I can respond to that. Slide 7, business is the most referred. It's correct, like your banks and all of that. They are the most referred. And professional, in fact, we'll bring the actual statistics in the different disputes because in most, they lead in the disputes that are referred. And we have not had the intelligence, because what we do, we intervene in the most referred. Because if you're a site that refers the most, that means there's a problem there. So we target those. And even in the retrenchment, it's the same principle. And we can then, what the team has started to gather was, you know, the issue of the 4IR in 189A is leading at the moment on the reasons for retrenchment. And the reason why also you see business to be the most leading, because others go to the bargaining council because they are sector-based. So that's why you find the numbers are skewed. It's not showing properly. So that's why, Jefferson, we've made it a rule that cases that are done at the bargaining council, when we report to the portfolio committee, we must also report about those cases so that then we can have a balanced picture of exactly who is the most referred. You'll be surprised to see actually it's not business. Public service is the most referred when you have a proper picture. And I can tell you, Jefferson, that there's a gatekeeper in the public service bargaining council who's refusing to give us information that you ask us to give about state entities that don't come to here. We've got a preliminary report, but they're refusing to do so. So we're dealing with the board of the bargaining council. If it fails, we'll escalate the issue. Or we don't accredit them. Then they forget the accredit and we can shut them down. But that's not the plan. The minimum wage. How do we deal with the rise in the caseload? There's no other way other than calling for resources here. It's killing us, Jefferson, this one. I'll put it bluntly, that's what it is. It's really killing us. We've adopted other methods that the non-commissioners, there are certain preliminary steps, because it is correct that the dispute of the minimum wage is not a legal dispute. It is a factual dispute. It's either you pay to another person or you don't. There's no other thing to argue. So we're trying to use non-commissioner on the initial stages, but if a decision has to be made, then we get the commissioner involved. But overall, minimum wage and basic conditions is seriously increasing our caseload, and we are not coping. We are not coping, Jefferson. We do need help on this one. The last thing we want is to reach a stage where you get a complaint that we're not taking any more cases because we can't afford them. And we're nearing that position at the moment. I have to make that very clear to the system so that there should be no controversy. We're nearing that position. I'm worried about the third quarter of the new financial year, given the massive cut that we have, because that's where we're heading at the moment. So, on the information you asked for, Jefferson, on the cases that gather dust and all of that, after our award is issued that are sitting in the labor court, we will do our best to do so, to get commissioners to get it. Others we have. But to get an accurate report, we need to get to the labor court. And there's no really proper system in the labor court that we have to get information. We have to physically go into the files and get the information. And many of these awards that we've issued, because we no longer have jurisdiction, once we've issued an award, workers just disappear. There's no collaboration between important institutions of constitutional creation, between us, the Labor Court, Labor Peace Court, and the Department of Justice, so that we can give you a dashboard like the one we have, so that we can see a true picture. So if I issue an award and it says there's a review because we get paper,
we must be able to track it, whether it goes to the labor court or it dies in between. We've got to have the tracking system. The IT system we're talking about to link with the labor court, for them to have a recording system, to have a case management, we've tried that project, but due to resources, we're unable to complete it. So we stand out having systems that work, but those that feed from us don't have our identity in terms of infrastructure and systems to do that. So there is a rupture between us and the labor court and the other institutions. I hope I've covered all the questions, Chairperson.
No, thank you. Thank you very much. I think for the benefit of the other members, Honorable Mugabe was just being professional enough to say, Chair, I would like to have at an appropriate time to have a one-to-one with the Commission. But he was saying that in Zulu. No, thank you. Thank you very much. I think we have received two presentations which are very important. I'm saying very important because at the center of those presentations, it's about men and women that are working outside the streets around Parliament, who may be frustrated, not even know where to go. I'll make an example, maybe that if he can't find a labor court, but that person knows, or he or she knows that there is Parliament which has got a commit. Just make an example. So we have a huge number of our communities that are ignorant, not of their own making, unfortunately. I always say this, that majority of our people are ignorant, not of their own making. It's the system that has been very brutal and cruel, which then necessitated, because of the struggles, to have these institutions. But unfortunately, very few of those benefit from those institutions. And therefore, it's not only the responsibility of the Department of Employment and Labour and its entities, but it's also our responsibility as public representatives to what I like mostly about our questions are that it's questions that are centered around how best to empower our people in one way or another. So the issue of outreach on both for both the entities that have presented today, not only, I know, not only radio stations, but local newspapers, which are read day in and day out, but in the center, the issue of language. I think we're not going to be apologetic about it. Last month there was what was called a mother don't day, mother tongue day. That thing, you may take it with a pinch of salt, that statement, but it's a very profound statement. I speak Xhosa, I'm from a Xhosa clan. But my children and my grandchildren, they go to a private school and be taught in English. When at home, they are speaking a different language. What is it? When that thing was raised by one of the SATU members in a meeting, we were all taken aback. That one thing that you are not, we are talking about the failure rate, we are talking about, but there is one thing, how then do you teach a child on a language that he or she does not speak at home? So I think as we move forward, as much as it is going to be a challenge, as we move forward, we will have to look into this. It's quite an emotive an issue, but we have got 11 languages in our country. but other people will tell you that English is a universal language. But I know African speaking, they don't, they're not apologetic. African speaking people, they're not apologetic. So we can't be apologetic. It's quite sad in a mall, honorable members, you listen to a mother weep low, walking with his son in a mall, speaking English. Out of school, instead of speaking Zulu. Well, I don't want to go into the politics of language and what are they, but it's what we are faced with. In whatever we do, we must have that ability, as much as we can be forever talking about our past, but our past must enable us to move forward. And in that, it's what you've raised, it's the sitting, which is done in English, but all these people are speak vernacular. So as we move forward, we'll then have to look into those. It's not about what we want. I said initially, that's the legacy that we are to leave, so that people understand that if we say we are a country, that we are to bring everybody together, it's going to be very important that we understand, to become tolerant, but not at the expense of the stresses that have been waged by a number of. So these institutions are very important. We wouldn't be seated here, honorable members, if it wasn't workers of this country who fought, and some of them lost their lives. Some of them, we don't know where they are buried. Some of them, they don't even. So these institutions are very important. We can never be apologetic about that. We thank you very much, and please, we need that information. Please, we're going to need that information. We will then, yes, we have come to the end of the presentation. Thank you very much. As you will then be leaving, I will request the honorable members of the committee to just remain for some very important announcements. And And for the adoption of the program, as per our agenda. Our program, if you go to the next page, you will see we're in week 6. And then on the 11th of March, we will then, that is what is then going to be happening. Then on the 13th and the 12th and the 13th of March is going to be our oversight. And then on the 8th week is going to be, we're bringing Stats SA and the briefing by the FC Plus, the Department of Monitoring and Evaluation. And then we will consider our outstanding quarterly reports of entities and if they are. In fact, I think I'll request that you also add the report of our workshop. We're doing that next week. I think that is, we first, before we make some comments, can we, the chair, can we get a mover and a seconder of the of our program. Honourable Ngabane.
No, thank you, Chairperson. I move for the adoption of this program, Chair, but we need to also indicate where are we going to conduct this oversight on the 13th and 14th of March, as we have already presented. It doesn't appear in our program.
We will make an announcement on that. Honourable Jane, is there any second?
Yes, I disagree with the
Our oversight is going to take place. We have specially requested that we conduct our oversight on one of our entities, which is then going to be on the 13th and the, on the 12th. It's on the 12th because we'll be traveling on the 12th. The actual day is the 13th, which is going to be in Pretoria because their offices are in Pretoria on compensation fund. The whole day. When we say the whole day, it then means we will all travel on Saturday morning back to our places. What is important, therefore, is then going to be, is the whole day, members, because we must take our time. Remember that they've got a new system. There were a number of allegations that have been said. I've received a letter from one of our guests who have said something that I'm not taking it kind on behalf of the committee and the department and the entity. But we will really be able, because what is important is that we are to now physically have be exposed to this system that they have migrated to. So all of us must show interest. So it's a Friday, that's why we are reporting now that it's a Friday that you must block for all of us to be there. So what is going to be important is that you must give the committee section, Portia in particular, that on Saturday, then you will then be traveling from where to where. Are you coming back to Cape Town? Are you staying in Pretoria? And all that. So that we don't have a situation. If you are not going to be able to attend, indicate now, not unless that time is going to be conditions beyond your control. Because if they book and you don't show, you take responsibility of all that. We will come to plenary on Thursday, the 12th. We will leave from here to airport. We will sleep over in Pretoria. She will then indicate to us, so you must come with all your things here, because we will be leaving from Parliament to airport. So that is the situation, honourable members, because we thought that it is going to be important, because it's going to also be an important subject in our debate, in our budget vote debate. It's one of those. So that's why we have then pleaded with the powers to be that we were not allowed for Monday, because we thought Monday will be fine. We were told that parties have complained that Monday is party day, is constituency day, and whatever. We thought that Friday will be much better. So Portia is here. Communicate with Portia so that she then does a. If you are going to take your own car
to airport indicate that on Thursday. If you have got your own transport, the only thing that is not going to happen, I want to make it very clear, honorable members, and stress, they're not going to say transport must move here and go back to your, and go to your park. Bring everything of yours here, we are leaving from Parliament. I think that is that's what is, we wanted to announce. Having said that, thank you very much. Plenary starts at 3.
Thank you.
Can you? Yeah, sure.
Thank you.